And so the book of Ecclesiastes, we get that name for the book from a Hebrew word that's introduced to us at the very beginning in chapter 1, if you will recall. There's a Hebrew word, Koheleth, and many of your Bible translations will probably refer to that as the preacher, right? Because what Koheleth in the Hebrew, what it simply means is the one who addresses the assembly, right? So typically, when we have that translated in the Greek, the word assembly can mean ekklesia, and that's the same word we use for church, right? So whenever we're saying one who's addressing the assembly or one who's addressing the ekklesia, that is the one who's addressing the church, and so we would call that a preacher, right? And so that word assembly in the Greek, ekklesia, is where we get Ecclesiastes from. So basically, Ecclesiastes is just telling us that it's the words of the preacher. That's basically where we get that name from. And in chapter 1, we see that the preacher that we're talking about here, he is the son of David, and he's the king of Israel. And so the traditional view is that the author, or that the preacher in this book, or Koheleth in the Hebrew, that is King Solomon, David's son, and who was the one that ruled on his throne after David passed away. And so what most scholars believe then with this being written by Solomon is that what we're seeing is Solomon at the end of his life, describing his pursuits in his life as he, through his life, has had ups and downs. He's sought the Lord and been faithful to God, but then there's also periods of time where he had fallen away and sought after other gods and disobeyed God's commands. And so what it seems is, as if what he's doing here is he's addressing God's people, the assembly, and what he's doing is he's trying to show them and teach them life lessons and maybe help them learn from his mistakes and show them how he had gone after these other things and how he found them all to be hevel, which is a Hebrew word that is used over, or at least 38 times within this book. You'll see it used again tonight. And that word in your translations will probably say vanity or maybe meaningless, right? So depending on your translation. But the word in the Hebrew is hevel. And what that simply means is it's like smoke or vapor. And so if you can imagine, if you were to see smoke or vapor, you could see it there, right? You could see that it actually exists. But you know like how smoke or vapor, it dissipates, it disappears very quickly. If you saw it and reached after it and tried to grab onto it, you couldn't hold on to it. And he said, and what he's basically describing is after he's gone after all of these different things in his life, he's found that all of them are like that, like hevel, like trying to grab after smoke. You can see it, but it disappears quickly. You know, you can't hold on to it. And he says, so too, life, it is short, it's brief. And it's also elusive, right? You can't hold on to your life. You can't keep it. It's a breath. It's here today and gone tomorrow. And so then what he does is he starts to ask the question, so what does it profit us if life is so short? If it does disappear, if we can't cling on to these things, if we, you know, what is the benefit? What is the meaning or purpose of life? Can we find fulfillment? That's really the question that he's really asking us and having us work through in our own spirits through this book. And so through the chapters thus far, what we've seen is he's gone on different quests, right? Different pursuits where he's going to say, well, maybe I can find the meaning of life. Maybe I can find purpose and fulfillment if I just would go after these different things. And so we saw he went after wisdom. Was his first choice. He thought if I could gain all of God's or all of the world's wisdom, then maybe I would be able to find that answer. But when he found an increased in wisdom, he says he increased in grief, rather it increased his vexation. So he actually was frustrated as he gained more worldly knowledge rather than being alleviated or comforted by it. Then after that, we saw in chapter 2 that he decided, okay, well, if wisdom doesn't work, well, then I'm going to go after pleasure. I'm going to just enjoy my wealth, and I'm going to enjoy my mansions, and I'm going to enjoy anything that basically catches my eye, whether it's sex, right? Anything that would be pleasurable, I'm just going to enjoy that and see if I can find satisfaction and fulfillment in that. And then once again, he says that this too was meaningless. And so then he discusses about how we all experience this great equalizer, which is death, right? You can be wise, you can be a foolish person, but ultimately we all are going to die. And no matter how well you live your life, we all have that same end result. But then in chapter 3, he then gives us a glimmer of hope where he explains that though life may seem short and it's elusive and even repetitive at times, there is a hope for eternity because there's someone who's above the sun, right? He describes everything under the sun as hevel, but there is one who is above the sun, and that is God. And so he explains that God actually is working out all of these seasons in our lives, the ups and downs, for his glory, and he's actually making everything beautiful in its time. And so he's giving us some hope here that there is something that we are to hope for and to look after. And so he continues to go on and explain some different things. And he goes into another pursuit explaining how even if we pursue popularity or the praise of people, that won't work either. And then what we saw last time in chapter 5, he moved away from just these secular categories where he looked at the palace, he looked at the worker, he looked at, you know, all of these other things that we had talked about. Now in chapter 5, what he did is he went to God's house and he actually looked at the worshiper. So that would be specifically us, right? When we come to God's house, he says, you're supposed to come to God's house with reverence. You're supposed to think about God as you're approaching him and recognizing what you're coming to do when you come to worship him and to take it very seriously. And so what he does is he tells us two things. He says, first, as you're approaching God's house, you need to make sure that you are entering God's house prepared to hear, or that is to Shema. So whenever you come to worship God, one of the primary ways we worship God is actually come prepared to hear and to heed it, or to listen, to learn, and to live it out. And so that's the first thing that we're called to do as we enter God's house. We have to come prepared for our lives to be changed. Then the second thing he says, now when you go to the house, and after you come eagerly to learn and to listen, he then says, and whenever you speak, make sure that your weight or your words have weight, that your words matter, that you actually will, you know, limit your words so that you can make sure that you, when you speak, it's wise. And that would be when we pray. Right? So when we pray together, whoever preaches, right? Whenever I'm sharing the word, it means to be important that I'm prepared and I know what I'm about to say, that it's, that's wise, hopefully, right? Or, you know, whenever we sing praise songs, that we're not just singing the lyrics, but we actually are singing from the heart. And so he's telling us that we need to make sure that our words carry weight and that there's honor and reverence with what we're saying to God. And then it specifically addresses vows. And he says how there were many people that were coming to God's house, and one, they weren't coming to listen, but then two, they would come and make all these great vows, like, I'm going to give this much money, or I'm going to sacrifice this animal to the Lord. And then it would come where the ministers would come to collect whenever they had promised a certain date, and they'd say, oh, I'm sorry, you've made a mistake, you've made an error, and we're not going to pay it, we're not going to give it. And so what we see here is him explaining that it's better to not even make God promises if you're not going to fulfill them. But he says, but if you made a promise to God, you need to keep your vow. And so that was kind of the challenge then at the end, was to make sure that we pay God what we owe him. And then ultimately it gives us this call in the end of verse 7 where it says, fear God. And that's the key theme of the book, really. What Solomon is doing is he's wanting us to understand what it means to have the fear of the Lord, or the fear of God. That is a reverential awe and wonder of who God is. So all that being said, that's going to lead us to where we're at this evening in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8, and we're going to read through this the rest of this chapter and chapter 6 this evening. And so what we're going to see here is, if you'll recall right at the end of chapter 5 how he's telling us to pay God if we make a vow, so too he's going to continue to talk about wealth again. And you might almost seem like, wait a second, this seems a little repetitive here. You're almost going to be like, I feel like I've already heard this sermon. And I think part of that has to do with how God works. Sometimes God knows that we hear something once and we didn't do what we just heard at the beginning of chapter 5, right? We didn't come prepared to listen. So maybe he's saying, I need to address this again. It also could be that with Solomon, like all of us, sometimes we go through different seasons and thoughts and emotions, right? And it's kind of like we go back and forth, right? Have you ever done that before? You're working through something and you're like, well, this is a solution. And you're like, no, that doesn't work. And so then you go over here in your mind and you're like, no. And then you go back to the other solution again and you're like, well, maybe. And then you're like, no, I already found this problem last time. So I think almost Solomon is doing that here. He's kind of wrestling within himself as he's speaking to the congregation about wealth again, about not just when we pay God, but also about the wealth when it comes to the injustices with government and our own spirit in our own position and perspective on wealth and riches. So that's where we're going to be this evening. And let us read this together in verse 8. It says, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. That's the word hevel there. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt, but those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, that's hevel, and it is an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place? All the labor of man is for the mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already, for it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? So what we're seeing here is, you know, as I said, there's certain parts where it's like glimmers of hope. Well, many have categorized chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes as maybe the most depressing and the darkest chapter. So, Lord willing, after chapter 6, we're going to start seeing some more light, and Solomon's going to maybe start working some more things out for us. But I do think that there's a point. I think there's a purpose for what Solomon's doing here. But if we go to just the beginning of what we've read then, in chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, well, really verses 8 to 17, what we're going to see at the beginning here is almost another pursuit, or really a reminder of a previous pursuit. And what we're seeing here is that the pursuit of wealth produces weariness. I think that's what he's going to be describing here. It's this ongoing thing that Scripture reminds us, right? That if we are chasing after riches, if we're so consumed with money, it's going to lead to us being weary and left wanting more. And it's not going to be very satisfying or fulfilling. Once again, it's not going to meet that need. That it's not going to answer these questions that Solomon has. But in verses 8 to 9. It's interesting, at the very beginning of this section, most scholars differ on interpreting the very first two verses. Now, majority of them agree on all of the other verses that are going to be read this evening, but it's interesting, for the first two verses, there's some difference of opinion, and from what I understand, it's in the Hebrew, it's very difficult to interpret. If we'll just read this part just again, it says, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. So, at least at the beginning, what it seems is if Solomon is saying, you know, we just talked about paying God, and now it seems as if there's going to be some money somehow relating to government or to officials, right? And it seems as if what he's describing is that we shouldn't be shocked when we see that there's oppression and injustice that is present on every level of society, right? When we see that there's good and bad people, we're also going to see that on different levels of society, there's also going to be oppression and injustice. Think earlier in chapter 4, Solomon said that he saw injustice rampant everywhere, even the places that you shouldn't expect it. He said, you're seeing these things happening and going on. And so what many think is that what's being described here, especially as we look through the rest of the chapter, is this discussion of how there's a hierarchy of corruption going on, and that we need to recognize that that's just a way of life, that it's something that's just going to happen. Now, what some people will take from this is say, well, verse 9 actually seems to maybe be something positive here. It seems that maybe what verse 9 is saying is that it's saying that government actually, though it can be corrupt, it ultimately still has some redeeming qualities, and that you still want the king because at least it keeps anarchy from rising up. And so maybe there's a benefit there of a king being there. However, I think it might better fit with verse 8 of thinking is the king also can benefit from the corruption, that he also is taking advantage of individuals. And so what we could possibly see being described here is the bureaucracy of the wealthy class taking advantage of the poor class and basically taking their money when they have the opportunity. And it says that, you know, it says that there's a higher official over another. Some take that to mean what that means is you have either they're looking after each other and they're all in cahoots, or it could mean that you have one taking advantage of somebody else, and then on top of them, you have another one taking advantage of them. But, like I said, this is not an easy passage to interpret, and what I would recommend if you are interested in trying to understand just these two verses better, read different translations, because what you'll see is if you read the NASB, the New King James, the King James, the NIV, the ESV, the NLT, they're all going to kind of differ a little bit. Some of verse 8 will be positive, some will be negative, some will say verse 9 is positive, some will say negative. But ultimately, I think that we can say there is a clear part of this text which says we shouldn't be shocked when we see oppression and injustice, even in governing authorities. I think that's the first part that we should see, because we know that government likes power and they like money, right? And now, all that being said, I think that can now help us, as inform us as we move forward into the more clear passages. Because what I think this is going to show us is that just like the governing authorities can be greedy and want money and they will oppress and show injustice, so too many of us will struggle with the same issue. We might not be, you know, super high up on the totem pole, but even us, sometimes we will take advantage of the people that we are above. And what we'll start to do is we'll allow covetousness and greed in our hearts to oppress the poor or oppress people below us. But what he's going to show us is that we shouldn't be doing this. This shouldn't be our goal, because what it does is ultimately greed will rob us of our joy. So if you want to actually enjoy life and find joy, greed is not going to be the answer here. And in fact, he's going to say that it's going to be the opposite of what you're looking for. So let's then move to verse 10. Where it says this, it says, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. So clearly, right out the gate, what are we seeing here? It's saying the more you have, the more you are going to want. It's saying that if you love silver, right, if you really desire it, it's not going to be enough. You're just going to want more silver when you get it, right? I've used this analogy. I know that maybe some people might be getting sick of it, but I think it's such a powerful analogy for the desire for riches and wealth is, you know, because scripture, well, before I read that or before I give the analogy, in 1 Timothy 6, 9 to 10, it kind of describes riches and wealth as like a trap. It says, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So this is describing how many people have allowed their greed to consume them, right? It's become a snare or a trap, right? They thought, well, it's just a little bit of desire here. But no, what it ultimately does, it just takes over. And it basically leads to all different types of evil, which I think would go back to what we saw with the governing authorities, right? This oppression and injustice because of greed. And so what I think is the good analogy that I love about this this is it's desiring wealth or being greedy or coveting other people's property. It's like drinking salt water. I've used that before. It's, you know, when you drink the salt water, it looks good, especially if you're really thirsty and you're like, this would quench my thirst. But as you drink it, all it does is make you more thirsty, right? You've ever heard the people that drank the salt water and then they became delirious? They start seeing things and they they think that they see land and then they get off the boat and they swim and then they don't ever find land. Because what it does is as you drink more and more salt water, you become more thirsty and it ultimately just destroys you from the inside. Likewise, the same thing when we think that we're going to find fulfillment or joy in just becoming rich or becoming wealthy. And there's other scriptures that warn against this exact same thing. In Proverbs 23, 4-5, it says, "Do not overwork to be rich, because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven." So he's basically saying here is, do not overwork to be rich. That basically flies in the face of almost the American dream today. It's like, no, work really hard and you can get the nicest house. You can get all of these luxuries. You can get all of these freedoms, right? Just keep working, keep striving and become the most successful person you possibly can be, right? And he says in Proverbs, Solomon is saying, because Solomon wrote Proverbs as well, he's basically saying, don't make that your end goal. You know, actually we'll see in Proverbs 13:22, that he's not saying don't hate money. You don't have to. Money can be useful. In fact, he says that you should leave a legacy for your children's children. So there's a balance here of harmonizing scripture, of being responsible with your wealth and your resources and working diligently and productively. But don't make it to where you're just constantly consumed with more and more stuff, where all you want to do is you want to be the biggest, you want to be the best, you want to have all of the nicest things. He says you have to recognize that if you're trying to be satisfied in these things, it's just like drinking that salt water. You're not going to be. It's actually going to be worse. The more you have, the more you're going to want. And I think that's what verse 10 is pointing out. When you love these abundance, there's just going to be more increase. And once again, it's saying it's vanity, it's hevel. Verse 11 then moves on and gives us another reason why we shouldn't be chasing after riches. So not only does the more you have result in the more you want, we also see in verse 11, the more you have, the more people will come after it. Now this is interesting. It says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. Now, I think that's really interesting, and I'm sure many of us probably know this, right? If you've ever seen someone who became really wealthy, maybe they won the lottery, right? Or maybe they just got a really, really good job all of a sudden, and maybe their other people in their surrounding circles didn't maybe have as good a job. You notice that as you make more money, you start having more people that become dependent on you, right? And especially if you're someone that becomes generous early on, then they think, that's someone I can come back to, right? And so there's in one sense that it's a positive thing, right, where if you do have money, you can take care of family members. But we also notice that it can expand beyond that. It can become problematic. It can become your friends. It can be distant friends. It can be associates. It can be people you don't even really know, and you just see that they're becoming more of a leech, right? They just want your resources. They don't care about you. But then even going back to the beginning of this section, you can also think the government. Doesn't the government love when you make more money? Because they like to come eat at your table, don't they? They like to tax everything. In fact, if you even were to give your neighbor a nice gift, and if it goes above a certain threshold, they get some of that gift. Isn't that interesting? So I think that this is showing that, you know, the more you have, you're going to notice more people want it. And in fact, it's interesting, especially if you're close to someone, even though you don't have the resources, but they do, you almost feel entitled to it. And maybe you've felt this before, right? Where you feel a little jealous, right? You're like, well, I've always been their friend. They should help me out. They should give me a little bit, you know? It's almost like we expect their success to be given to us for some reason. But I think that that's what he's kind of drawing on here in verse 11. Likewise, in verse 11, the second half, we see it says that the more you have, the more you realize it does you no good. It says here at the second half, it says, so what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? And I think what this is describing is ultimately when you get all this wealth, right, and you start buying things, and then you have everyone that comes and starts taking some of it and eating your food and utilizing all your stuff, what you realize is really what do you do with it once you have it? You basically can look at it, right? That's what you get. I mean, there's not a lot of profit ultimately, like eternal profit. I mean, you get a nice TV. It's pretty. What do? You sit and you look at it. You get a nice car. I mean, other than when you drive it, Right? And what's the difference when you're really driving it? Do you really notice how beautiful the car is? I mean, maybe your inside's a little nicer than somebody else's inside, but it's a car. You just look at it. When you go to a vacation and you spend all the money to go to a nice distant land, what are you going to do? Sit somewhere comfortable, probably, and look at it. Look at the scenery. Look at the beach. Look at the ocean. Look at the sun. You know, look at the palace. You know, we look at these things. And earlier in the book, if you notice, what did it say? Our eyes are never satisfied. Once we see one thing, we want to see something else. You see Mount Rushmore, but you also want to go see something else. You want to go see the Grand Canyon, right? Because that's not enough. We want to keep seeing. And after we see everything on the earth, we want to go see Mars. We want to see everything, right? So we see that that there's not really any satisfaction here. All we can do really is, once we get all this stuff, we can look at it. People will come take it, and we can look at it. Verse 12, what we see here is it says, the more you have, the more you have to worry about. So not only when you have more stuff, you also have more responsibilities, and you have more things you have to tend to and think about it and fix and organize and all these different things, right? And so in verse 12 it says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. So it's describing two different individuals. You have one man who's a laborer, who works hard in the field, right, all day, beating down by the sun, right? And by the end of the day, whether he eats a lot or he just doesn't have very much and he eats just a little bit to get him by, he's going to conk out. And maybe you've been like that when you've had a long day of work, right? I know, like, on mission trips, like, you're basically up and you're going all day, and by the time, even though, you know, those mission rooms or mission little house that we're in, is, you know, they have the nice part of the house, but we're in a not part of the house. When you're in the nice part of the house, it's a little hot, but the thing is, by the time you're in bed, you don't care. You're ready to go to sleep. You know, you're exhausted. And I think that's kind of what it's describing. You don't even have to have the nicest house. You don't even have to have all the AC or all the luxuries. Basically, if you work hard all day, and at the end of the day, you're going to be able to sleep well. You're going to have a nice, sweet sleep. But then on the other hand, for those who have a lot of stuff and a lot of money, they're constantly thinking about their money. They're thinking about, what am I supposed to do with this investment? You know, what am I going to do? This car now has a problem, right? Because if you have multiple cars, eventually one car is going to have a problem. Maybe your AC went out. Maybe your heat went out. Maybe, you know, you have to deal with the basement. Maybe you have to do something with the attic. Maybe you have to do something with the second garage, right? There are just so many different responsibilities and problems and things you have to deal with, especially if you have more people coming in and utilizing these things, because more people come when you have more stuff. So more people potentially can, you know, break or utilize these things. I know that we have family members that are generous that will help let younger family members use cars. And I know we've had examples where they wrecked the car, right? So then you have to deal with the issue, right? So I think that's another thing. You have just more things you have to worry about, you have to deal with because of your wealth. Verse 13. Yes. Verse 12. Yeah.
And you find out it's the rich people that are needing the sleeping pills because they can't sleep at night because they're worried.
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to that. It's a simple life. It's the simplicity of life. You work hard during the day, and then when you go to bed, you worked hard, and you're tired, and you're exhausted. You're able to sleep good, and also you don't have anything else that's going to keep you up at night. Like I said, the rich person is, like I said, thinking about all these other things, and that laborer is not having to deal with all that. Yeah, absolutely. Moving to verse 13, I think what we see here is the more you have, the more you can hurt yourself by holding on to it. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. So it's saying it's actually it can have problems that will cause in your life or will arise in your life. And I think some of this might result in like losing your track of your priorities, right? If you're so focused on your job, right? And I know people that become workaholics, right? They can't take time to themselves. And that can actually affect them physically, right? They can actually have physical problems because they're not going to the doctor. They're not taking a mental health day. Likewise, you can lose track of close loved ones, right? Because if you don't take time you know, for your family, your spouse, you can see relationships end, right? There are kids that don't have relationships with their parents because their parents always worked and never took time to go watch them play sports or went and take them out for ice cream. Or there's just a lot of things. We lose our track of priorities. We can become obsessive. I also think that this can relate to corruption and unethical methods, right? Because if you're someone that's got to like the highest point in your like your career path, now what you want to do is you want to hold on to it, right? And so sometimes if it all of a sudden looks like it's not going to allow you to stay at the top of the hill, you might do some corrupt, unethical methods like the people that mentioned in verse 8. To keep that power. And so what it does, it actually is to your hurt, both physically, spiritually, relationally, emotionally. There's going to be detriments to your person because of the more that you have. In verse 14, it says, the more you have, the more you lose. And that's what we see in verse 14. It says, but those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. So it's saying that right here we have riches that perish through misfortune. What this is probably describing is things like when you have a lot of money, you have to have these high risk investments, right? You have these high stakes, right? Maybe people have got involved with Bitcoin or something like that, right? You know that that's a higher risk, right? You put money into it and whenever it does good, it like jumps super good. But there's also a chance that it can flip on its head really badly. I think that's also what it's kind of describing here is when you're, you know, when you're putting a lot of money in, you're putting investments in, you're relying on like this shipment to go, especially back in this day, when a lot of your stuff goes on a boat, it might not come back. But you have to utilize these things to continue to grow your business, to trade, things like that. So it could be due to high risk investment. It could be due to natural disasters, but it also could be due to theft, right? Because you could have it all, and that could make you a bigger target, because if they know that's where the person has all the stuff, that's also another way to lose it. And so what it's describing here is it results in not being able to beget it to your son, right? So you could actually have it all, and maybe you know someone like that that was super rich at one point, and now they got to the point where they don't have anything to give to their children. And that, once again, Solomon said, it's a good thing to have and leave a legacy for your children and your children's children. But here, whenever you're getting these high stakes scenarios, you might actually end up not being able to give them anything in the long run. And then finally, in verses 15 to 17, I think what we see is that the more you have, the more you leave behind. In verses 15 to 17, it says, as he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil, just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? At all his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. So what this is describing is that we come into this world naked and we also leave this world that way. And the fact is that if you have all of this stuff, right? Let's say you have more than anybody else in the world. We know that you don't take it with you, right? Once again, this might sound repetitive because in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he basically kind of said the same thing, right? So what he's saying basically is when you make all of this money and whenever you pass on, you don't get to take any of it with you. So you're going to be the one that loses more in the end because you have more stuff. And we actually see this in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7, where he says, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. It's the same, that same thought process here. And so we see this clear warning about if we try to pursue wealth and if we try to find satisfaction and purpose and meaning in that, we're going to find ourselves to be weary, frustrated, and let down in the end. We're not going to find it. We see all of these more you have, we see really there's a lot of negative consequences for it. So what is the good news of this chapter? Well, in verses 18 to 20, I think what we see here is that there is some encouragement. And what we see is that gratitude is good for the soul. I think what we're teaching here is that we're called to practice gratitude. In verse 18, it says, here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. Now you might be like, that seems like it flies in the face of what we just read of all these other verses about it's not good to have all this more stuff. But what he's saying is, when we change our priorities and we're not trying to just gain more and more and more, and we're not trying to become rich or more wealthy than our neighbor, rather when we're just saying we're trying to work, we're trying to make enough for ourselves and you know to maybe leave a respectful amount for our you know our descendants, our family members, we're just trying to you know do our best and be responsible adults with our job and our work, what we're supposed to do is not worry about trying to make more. Rather, just enjoy it. Be thankful for what you've been given, the opportunities and the works, the labor, right, or the fruits of your labor, and just enjoy it. So what we're actually, I think, being told here is that we're to view the blessings of life and see them as gifts of joy, and what we're supposed to do is just receive them and accept them with gratitude. In fact, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 18, it says, "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you." So I think this is actually showing us that if we want to enjoy life, right, if we want to find contentment in life, we need to practice this thing called gratitude or giving thanks, right? Because God actually, it's interesting, we're being told in verses 18 to 20, God actually wants us to enjoy this life. That doesn't mean that we're not going to experience suffering. There will be trials. There will be suffering that you as a follower of Christ will experience. But he does still want you to really enjoy this life. This is a gift from God. Life is a gift. And so what he's saying is, but the way that you will find that is not being consumed with materialism, but just being thankful for what God has given you. It's rather than always craving more, it's being invited to be happy with less. And what's so cool is when we're talking about the discipline of practicing gratitude, right? We all have probably heard of it's good to give thanks, right? We have Thanksgiving, right? Where hopefully a lot of us will take time to do that. But there's actually like a chemical and a biological component to this, not only a spiritual thing, but you realize there's something called your sympathetic nervous system. And what happens there is whenever you stress or worry, right, it engages that sympathetic nervous system, right? And what it does, it's called like your fight or flight system, right? When you're really stressed, if something bad happens, it gets your body like really revved up, like ready to go, react, things like that, and it can make you really stressed and anxious, right? And you don't really get to enjoy very much whenever that's going on, right? Because you're so stressed and tightly wound. But there's also something within you that's called your parasympathetic nervous system. Now, what that is it actually gives you peace. It gives you contentment. It allows you to relax, like maybe after you've had a good meal, or maybe you're with loved ones, or maybe right as you're about to doze off to sleep. It's that parasympathetic nervous system. What's so cool is that whenever you practice gratitude, you start to just think about the things that you have, the things you're thankful for, the good things in life. It actually engages that nervous system. And what's so cool is that it counteracts the other. So if you're like, I'm really, really stressed, it might sound kind of corny or cheesy to say, just take a moment and just start thinking about all the things you're thankful for. Not only, like I said, not only I think is it spiritual, it's biblical, but I also think it's just biological. When you start to think about the things you're thankful for, when you think about all the things God has given you, it will actually make you experience joy again. So it's so cool that we actually can do this and it actually works biologically as well. And one of the things that I want to maybe show us or challenge us to do is just think about this one simple thing that you can always be thankful for, is the value of waking in the morning, right? All of us woke up this morning, and I think I've even used this analogy before. If I were to give you or offer you $10 million today, many of us would probably think that would be awesome, right? We're like, you know, I could do a lot with $10 million. I would even give to the church. I would serve people, I would pay my bills, I would take care of my mother, my grandmother, right, whatever. I would take care of those needs, but it would be really nice to have. And I'm sure many of us, if you were just given $10 million today, most of us probably wouldn't turn it down, especially if we're not saying, you know, there's a catch, right? But what if I were to tell you, you can get the $10 million, you can do whatever you want with it, but tomorrow you don't get to wake up? How many of us are taking that $10 million? What if I changed it to 20 million, 100 million? Would you take it? I think most of us probably wouldn't. And you know what that means? Getting to wake up tomorrow is worth more than $100 million. Think how excited we would be if we had $100 million. You got to wake up this morning. Is that greater than the 100 million? Now think about this. Every single second you're living, you're breathing, your heart's beating, is once again, give God thanks. Gratitude, because that's what it's saying in this text in verse 18. It says, all of these things are a gift from God. Our wealth, our possessions, the ability to wake up in the morning, every single second of our existence is literally God giving us things that are worth more than $100 million. That's so cool to think about. And when we think about how good this is then, how great life in these gifts and these blessings are, how much greater then is our God, the one who gives them to us? If that's how valuable just 1 second is on the earth, over $100 million, how great is our God? I'm sure many of us, if we think about a loved one that's passed on, how much would you give just to see that loved one and talk to them for 5 minutes? Right? Think how valuable our time is on this earth. God has given us this, and it shows us once again, I think, of how good He is, and it gives us this opportunity to practice gratitude. But in verse 19, what it shows is not only are these blessings, the materials, a gift from God, actually, the ability to find enjoyment within them is also a gift from God. Think about that. Finding joy in the things that you've received are also a gift from God. Because what we're going to find in chapter 6 is there are people that can have all of the stuff, all of these blessings, and still not find joy or contentment. They're not able to practice gratitude because even gratitude itself is given to us by God. So finding joy in the blessings is also a blessing in itself. And so verse 20, what I think it then does is it's describing for us the individual who will recognize that they are to take time to slow down, to practice gratitude, and to enjoy the things that God has given them. It allows them to get through this life with joy in their heart, with gladness in their heart. So what I think it's really showing us is that without God, life is meaningless. It's hevel, like we've seen. If you take God out of the equation, all you get is before and after that we're going to discuss. But when you put God in it, it literally makes everything have meaning. Let me say that again. Without God, everything is meaningless. With God, everything has meaning. That's what changes. When you put God into the equation, it makes all of the difference for our world. And so I think we need to find and practice gratitude for God, for His presence, for His gifts of blessing, and for also the gift of being able to enjoy these blessings. So gratitude, I think we see, is good for the soul. Now, what we finally see in chapter 6, so verses 1 to 12 of chapter 6, what we kind of see is Solomon takes us back on an emotional roller coaster, right? So he gave us this kind of bleak picture for a second of all of these things. When you gain more, you have these bad consequences. But then he gives us this little nugget, verses 18 to 20, of saying we need to practice gratitude. We need to enjoy the things God has given us under the sun. It's a gift from Him, and we can find gladness in these days. But then he goes on and says, but there is an evil which I have seen under the sun. It is common among men, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it. But a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and it is an evil affliction. So he goes back to from enjoying, practicing gratitude, being thankful to, but there are people that God will allow to have all of these amazing blessings, literally everything His heart has desired. But even sometimes when you have these things, satisfaction is not guaranteed. So there's this man that has everything, but ultimately God can still withhold the joy. God doesn't have to give you joy just because you have all of this stuff. And so then he goes on in verses 3 to 6 to describe how people are living a living tragedy. Literally, there are people walking around the street today, and they are a living, breathing, walking tragedy, because he compares those who are living a life not finding true contentment, not practicing gratitude, not recognizing God and His goodness. And what they're doing is he says that they are to be more sympathy, or it's better to be a stillborn child, is the comparison he uses. Now, so many of us probably really mourn a stillborn child. That is such a dark thing. As I said, chapter 6 can be kind of hard to think about. But he's saying for someone who lives a life where they don't even have a proper burial because there's no one there to bury them, or because they have all of these things and they're trying to be satisfied in them, but they're never truly satisfied, and in fact that they work and labor and then somebody takes all of their stuff, he says that person is actually worse off than a stillborn, because a stillborn, at least that they are in rest. They're not aware of the suffering. This is an individual that suffers a great deal. In fact, it even describes someone who's had hundreds of children and also has been able to live 1,000 years twice. That's 2,000 years. So literally, you've lived longer than Methuselah twice, had 100 children, had all of this stuff, still not satisfied. And he says, that is a tragedy, to live a life like that. It's not worth it. And so what I think he's doing, he's trying to work up these emotions in us as we think about what it would be like to live this long, to have these things and not to be fulfilled in them. And so in verse 9, he says that we are to be content, once again, rather than chase after these unquenchable desires. And in verse 10, he kind of gives us another reminder about how life kind of has this repetitive nature. It's the same old, same old. We can't change these circumstances. And so he's giving us all of these different things, thinking about, you know, what it's like to be content versus not being content. But why does he give us this emotional pressure maybe in this text? Well, I think what he's doing is he's trying to bring us back to what we read at the very end of chapter 5, verse 7, where he says to fear God. He's wanting us to feel what it's like without God. He wants to awaken our longing for God, I think, because when we recognize if you don't have God, you could live to be 2,000, you could have 100 kids, you could have all of this wealth, but ultimately if God's not there to give you the ability to enjoy it and to have true meaning and purpose in it, then ultimately it's worthless. So I think he's actually drawing all this for a point. He's saying that he's wanting us to find the fear of the Lord is our source of true satisfaction. See, not only is the fear of the Lord the beginning of wisdom, but also the fear of the Lord is our true source of satisfaction. And so I think what we're actually being reminded, not only in this section, but the entire book, is that when we look at these things, when we think about wealth, when we think about pleasure, when we think about wisdom, we have to think that all of these things are good in them. They're all good things to enjoy, but we need to worship the giver and not the gift. That's the whole problem, is that all of these individuals that he's saying the problem is with is that they are worshiping the gift. They're worshiping the blessing and not the blesser, not the one who all blessings flow from. In 1 Timothy 6:17, we see this exact same thing. It says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. So I think that's the thing. It's we are to worship God who is the giver and not to just focus on all of these other things. As we read this Sunday, once again, when you seek the kingdom of God first, all these other things will be added to you. So put God first in your life. Seek after Him. Practice gratitude. Find contentment. And then enjoy the blessings of life and be responsible with them. And I think that's kind of what He's showing us in this section.